Hello, OT friends, and welcome to the Uncommon OT series. I'm Patricia Motis, and I'm your host, a Filipina-American, native New Yorker, current California transplant, bulldog mama, and an uncommon occupational therapist myself for the past 22 years. On this podcast, you'll hear me proudly feature the unique careers of occupational therapy practitioners working in non-traditional and role-emerging practice areas, settings where OT is uncommon. I invite you to receive a dose of OT inspiration, to learn, to think outside of the box, and to be energized and motivated to follow in these unconventional paths. Happy listening. Before we begin this episode, I want to highlight and extend a special thanks to our sponsors, TrueLearn and Picmonic. Picmonic is an excellent learning resource and study aid for occupational therapy and occupational therapy assistant students, whether you're studying for your classes or getting ready for the NBCOT exam. Picmonic is the only visual mnemonic learning tool that has been research-proven to increase retention and help students ace their exams through the use of audiovisual learning and intelligence-based repetition algorithms to help with long-term retention while studying. How I wish I had a learning tool like this back when I was in OT school. Try it for yourself and sign up today using the link in the show notes or code TRANSITIONSOT to score a discount of 20% off your Picmonic membership. Happy studying. So welcome back, everyone. Today's guest of honor is David Merlo. David is an uncommon occupational therapy practitioner who has never worked in an OT clinic a day in his life. Can you imagine that? Well, we're gonna talk a little bit more about that and his experiences in a few. But before, I wanna tell you a little bit about David. He is the managing director of Restoration Society Incorporated. It is a peer-operated community mental health agency in Buffalo, New York. And it was founded upon the recovery vision that all individuals can lead active lives filled with hope and satisfaction and make valuable contributions to our community. For 8 years prior, he was founding director of the Occupational Therapy Assistant Program at Bryant and Stratton College in Rochester, New York. Prior to that, he was professor and academic fieldwork coordinator for over 18 years at Erie Community College in Buffalo, New York. Trained through Boston University's Center for Psychiatric Rehabilitation, David is a certified psychiatric rehabilitation practitioner, in addition to being a licensed, certified occupational therapy assistant. He completed graduate studies in assistive and rehabilitation technology at University of Buffalo OT Department and Center for Assistive Technology. He earned an MS degree at Buffalo State College, focusing on adult education with emphasis on technology and supporting students with disabilities. David has presented at numerous conferences and co-authored articles on psychiatric rehabilitation, mental health recovery, assistive technology, and the role of occupational therapy assistants in clinical and community practice. He currently serves on the board of Haiti Rehabilitation Foundation, an organization that supports the first and only school in Haiti with four-year degree programs in both OT and PT. He serves in leader capacity with the Consortium of Psychiatric Rehabilitation Educators, an interprofessional community of practice. He is past director of AOTA Board of Directors and past representative of the AOTA Representative Assembly. He has served in numerous leadership and volunteer capacities within the New York State Occupational Therapy Association. So without further ado, I'd like to present to you David Merlo. Welcome, David.
Hi. Wow. That sounded pretty...
You've done a lot.
I'm a little overwhelmed with that. So it's embarrassing and yeah.
You've done a lot, and we're probably just going to be scratching the surface of what you've done. But you know, we're definitely going to highlight the most current things that you're doing, right? But welcome to the show. I am so grateful to you for spending the time with us and sharing your OT journey.
Well, thank you for inviting me. And let's talk. I love talking about occupational therapy assistance and mental health, and so let's go to it.
Yay. So let's get to it. But before we get to the nitty-gritty, let's hear a little bit from you. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, some of your favorite occupations, perhaps?
Yeah. Well, before I even discovered occupational therapy, I went to college with the goal of becoming a landscape architect. And I spent a couple of years doing that, and didn't really pan out for me. As much as I still was intrigued by that profession, it just wasn't a fit for me. So I've always enjoyed gardening, horticulture. Used to do little bonsai years ago. I had a greenhouse and things like that. And it's still an
I
occupation that I
love it.
really love engaging in now. And in fact, it's that occupation that led me into occupational therapy. So I'll tell you about that.
Yay.
After I completed school for landscape design, I kind of floated around, odd jobs and things like that. And I was intrigued by the State Psychiatric Hospital, Buffalo Psychiatric Center, which was a couple blocks away from where I had lived. And I kind of noticed that they had this old Victorian greenhouse on the back of this beautiful historic building. So I inquired about that, and I ended up taking on a volunteer engagement there, volunteering, working with the patients from the wards in that greenhouse. So every week, patients would line up in the hospital. They would escort them down, and I would spend an hour and a half in the greenhouse, just doing very simple things, taking cuttings, rooting plants, transplanting them, watering them, and things like that. And that's where this little light went on inside of me in terms of this idea of using something that I was passionate about, and kind of my enthusiasm for that passion, and kind of inviting other people into that. And it really, that invitation, I think, that inviting environment for the patients, it kind of drew them in. And we just gardened together. So,
Aw.
and that was great, and it was beautiful. And I always think back, because like in the wintertime in Buffalo, Buffalo's known for its snow, but
Yes.
every once in a while you get a sunny day in the wintertime when there's all the snow out there. And we just water the plants inside, so you have all these little drops of water that are sparkling from the sunlight, and that just the beauty, the smell of the earth and the plants, and then that calming drone sound of the exhaust fan, and quiet sound in the background. It was just like this combination of sensory experiences, and it was just so calming. And I never cured anybody. Nobody ever was cured of schizophrenia by coming to my little gardening club. But what I did realize is these are patients who otherwise could choose not to come to this. It was voluntary, but they chose to come every week. They wanted to be there. And
Yes.
so they were given that choice. They chose that. And for patients who are institutionalized, and this is at the tail end of deinstitutionalization, for them, I just imagine being given that choice, giving that opportunity, and them choosing to take that opportunity, and then engaging in some really calming, enjoyable, leisurely occupations. I kind of Back then, when I went to become an OTA, we talked about the therapeutic use of self, therapeutic use of activity, and therapeutic use of environment. Kind of those three pillars of OT. And
Yes.
I kind of visualized it right there. You had this beautiful environment. We had meaningful occupations that were, tailored to their level of engagement and interest. And then you had that therapeutic use of self. I wasn't their therapist. I wasn't their director. I was just some volunteer off the street. So I had this very kind of a partner or collaborative kind of relationship with them. And the things that we talked about were not about their mental illness, their sickness, their symptoms. We talked about the plants, and we rarely had deep conversations. It was mostly just about the plants, but that kind of created a level of comfort and familiarity one with another, where every once in a while there would be a little joke or something like that. And I just left that experience really feeling, first of all, blessed to be a part of something like that. But that's what inspired me to then, pursue becoming an occupational therapy assistant. And I pursued OT as a means to an end. I wanted, after that experience, to work in mental health. I
Yes.
never, I thought I was always interested in mental health, but I thought, do I want to be a social worker? At the time, there was too many social workers out there. I wasn't interested in becoming a psychologist, or I didn't envision myself being like a therapist, a counselor. I didn't know that there were any other roles where you can kind of use yourself as a therapeutic tool.
Yes.
So when I kind of was introduced to OT, that's when all these lights and whistles went off in my head, and I thought, this is
This
exactly
is it.
what I want to do. So I
Oh.
pursued that. And just a little comment about human volition and how human volition can change how you approach things. I was not a good college student originally when I went to college to be a landscape designer, landscape architect. I barely graduated, but when and in part because I struggled, I wasn't, I guess I really wasn't totally committed to my studies and things like that. But when I decided that OT was for me, I excelled. And so it's the same person. I was very average, in fact, below average academically. But when you matched passion with engagement, I think that could really change outcomes. And for
Yes.
me, I did really well. And I'm not saying that because I'm a really smart person. I don't think I'm that smart of a person. But and late years later, when I went into academia, I've always told students the same thing. It's not about being smart. It's about being really committed to something, so passionate that
Yes.
you're so hungry to learn. So I graduated from the OTA program, and I'm looking in the paper for jobs, and I have no interest in working in a clinical setting, and I didn't know what else was out there. There's an ad in the paper for a job looking for somebody with a background in horticulture and mental health.
Oh, wow.
So, first of all, where does somebody come up with something like that? But second of all, that was me. I had that background in horticulture, landscaping, and that experience in mental health, and then adding to that my degree as an OTA. So my first job was at Restoration Society, where I'm networking again. I was employed there to work in a clubhouse model program. We can talk about that if you want, but part of the program is they also had recently been awarded a grant to build a greenhouse, a commercial size greenhouse. So I was employed to run the greenhouse unit, where I worked with our club members who were interested in gardening and growing things, and we kind of used that to kind of build a little business and selling plants and things like that. And
Oh, I love
that was
it.
part of our engagement with people. So I
I
think I
love
covered a
it.
lot
I
of,
want to.
I went beyond your
I
question, but
definitely. No, well, the question really was tell us a little bit about your background, and also, the next one would have been what inspired you to do this type of OT work, right? Which you have covered. So
So
thank you for
yeah, I was
sharing all
hooked.
of
I
that.
was hooked, and I loved the freedom, the variability in my job role, and I loved that collaborative kind of relationship that that kind of work setting afforded me.
Oh, fantastic. Can you describe for us the uncommon OT work that you're currently up to?
Well, currently I am back at Restoration Society. So recently I've been in academia for 27 years. So I had worked at Restoration Society for about 10 years, and I then, through going on getting more education, I went into academia. So this past spring I decided it's time to move on. And I was toying with the idea of actually literally retiring. And then possibly doing something else. So I have actually, because I loved what I did at Restoration Society those years ago, when I left Restoration Society and pursued academia, I stayed on as a board member. I was on the board of directors of Restoration Society all those years. So as I was approaching my decision to retire, the CEO asked me if I would be interested in coming on as a director. So that is my retirement. So I'm
Yes.
now working as a full-time director of programs at Restoration Society. And I'm probably putting in more hours now than I even did when I was in academia, which was exhausting. But it's really different. It's that passion thing. I love it
Yes.
so much that I don't have that, what do they call it? The Sunday scaries. When
Yes.
every Sunday night having to go back to work, I don't have that anymore. I look forward to coming back, but it's a really busy place. And yeah.
Can you describe for us a little bit the population that you serve there and some of the needs that you might
Yeah.
address?
So our agency has been around for, I think, about 50 years. We started, during deinstitutionalization as kind of a solution or a one solution to serve people who are being discharged from state psychiatric hospitals. So
Got it.
the people that we serve are people who are probably the technical label is they are severely mentally ill or SMI. These are people who have had significant impairments due to a psychiatric diagnosis to the degree with that they've experienced multiple hospitalizations over the years. And these are people that most of them are taking some kind of medication to minimize their symptoms that they experience, along with their mental illness. These are oftentimes people who are living in poverty because of they're on disability. Many of them actually experience homelessness. Most of the people that we work with are not currently employed. So the services that we provide are homeless outreach services, supported housing programs. We operate supported employment services to help people that want to get a job. We will work with them. And I can describe what these supported models are. These are evidence-based models. And we offer other services where we actually, our agency is actually predominantly staffed by peers. And what that means is we employ people who have lived experience of mental illness, utilization of mental health services, and then their own recovery stories and journeys have brought them to a place where they've decided that they want to turn that around and use that experience and that wisdom to help other people. So they
Support others.
join our workforce. And in New York State, they actually have training for peers. New York State values the utilization of mental health peers in our workforce, so they have a peer training academy where you can actually become certified as a peer provider. So that's our workforce, and the population we serve are people who are have severe mental illness predominantly.
Got it. I love it. I love everything about what you just described. I'm a big fan of peer-oriented models myself. Are they how does it work with, I guess, and I'm completely segueing now because I'm stuck on what you just said. But how are they paid? Are they paid on stipend or are they paid a, I guess, a
They're paid
respectable
a
living wage?
well, I
Competitive
wouldn't say
wages, yeah.
anybody in mental health is paid a respectable living wage. I'll be very honest with you. A lot of our services is based on contracts with the state, other various state entities. The pay is not great, but it's a competitive, well, roughly a competitive wage that we would pay anybody. So we would never, ever consider just paying a peer a stipend or anything like that. They are doing valuable work, and they deserve, reasonable pay, standard pay for that. So we employ people in that way, and like I said, it's a well-known fact in New York State that our mental health workforce, whether you're a peer worker or whatever, the pay is a big issue, and recently, the governor has issued some incentives. In fact, our county Department of Mental Health, knowing that most of our mental health agencies are lacking sufficient workers, we're just not getting people taking on the jobs. You know, they're making some efforts to support us. We just actually had a county sponsored job fair last evening. So everybody kind of knows that people in the mental health workforce aren't paid enough. But it doesn't, has nothing to do with whether you're a peer or not. It's just that our society doesn't value that.
I ask that question too, and of course, again, I'm segueing, but we're going to get right back on track after this. But, you know, I've worked in vocational programs and understand that when there's earned income, that then, you know, tends to affect your fixed income, right? Or benefits that you may have, and or it may be affected over time. I know that trial work periods, et cetera. And I, you know, just think it's important for folks to be paid fairly, number one, but also to be paid in a way so that they can really prepare and plan, you know, sort of for that future, right? For that inevitability that you may lose your benefits, and you know, in some cases that included medical benefits, right?
Absolutely.
That can be detrimental to someone who has a chronic
Absolutely. And in fact, interesting you bring that up. So we actually have people on our staff who are, I would say, experts in benefits management. And we provide
that's fantastic.
As a service, whether you are a person who is a peer trying to be, you know, you want a job as an employee within our agency, we'll assist you with that. But we, you know, any of our customers who might be going through our supported employment services, we will refer them over to our benefits expert who will work with them on identifying, you know, what are the parameters around what you can earn, you know where are you getting close to the line where you know you're at risk of losing certain benefits. Some peers who work here are full-time employees, and they're not reliant on those disability benefits. They've achieved a goal that they've had to, you know, they want to fully earn their income. But we also have some peers who are employed on a part-time basis, and they specifically want to be able to work enough hours to, you know, enhance their lifestyle, which everybody wants to do, of course, but they don't want to jeopardize those benefits. So they work just under the number of hours that would then affect them. And that works very well for them. It allows us to create opportunities for people in the community that are in those situations. And we actually work with other agencies, more traditional clinical model agencies, by contracting with them and providing them with peers and to work within their agencies as well. So we're kind of known in the Buffalo area as an agency that, you know, another agency might reach out to us and say, you know, we want to employ some peers. Can you work with us? And we will contract with them, and we'll provide that peer workforce for them. And we have a lot of embedded supports to our peer workers in the agency. You know, we have a peer advisory council. We have a peer community of practice that meets on a regular basis. Actually, recently, we were at a state conference last week where a number of our peer workforce, in response to the tragic mass murder that happened in Buffalo at a Tops supermarket this past summer, well, some of the response in our agency was our peer workforce really banded together and kind of developed a kind of a support structure for one another, because a lot of them were really traumatized. One of our locations is very close to that market. We live in that community. So they actually presented at the conference in terms of our response to the trauma that a lot of our peer workers, as well as our customers, were experiencing. We had held a lot of kind of roundtable kinds of forums on a regular basis the weeks following that, just to open up the floor for people that wanted to talk about whatever. You know, there was no parameters around that, and we just use that time to really support both our workers as well as our customers who are feeling a lot of, you know, trauma from that experience.
Yes. Well, thanks so much for describing to us your setting and the folks that you work with there. It sounds like there's a couple of levels. You're working with the staff, right? Staff that also need support, but at the same time, you also have your clients that, your staff works with, right? So, lots of stuff going on. But before we dive any deeper into, what a typical day might be like for you, I guess I want to backtrack a little because, you've been practicing for many years. You're officially in your retired role right now, I guess, right? So I, and part of what we try to showcase on this podcast is sort of your path, right? Like, how did you get from, I know we might have to kind of trim it down a little bit, but how did you get from restoration society to back to restoration society
Okay,
again,
sure.
right?
So in my
And
time, okay, I'm sorry, finish your question. I'm sorry.
I guess I just wanted to also be more specific in terms of, as far as our listeners, right? And how if they're probably curious, like, how does one get from this role into all the way into that role? And also within, I'm sure you'll talk a little bit about the different roles that you've also, the different hats that you've worn between those two roles.
Well, part of the problem is that my leisure occupations are so entangled with my profession. It's always been that way for me. I just am just you kind of live and see and breathe occupational therapy. For me, it's something that I couldn't separate from myself. So I really enjoy like learning. I really enjoy, discovering and seeing other things out there. And it's just I'm very interested in things like equity and, social justice and things like that. I don't know if you want to call those hobbies or leisure pursuits or what. So I've always been kind of driven in that way. So my early years at Restoration Society, I worked for there for 1 year. I left after about a year and a half because I thought I need to get a real job. I need to work in a more traditional kind of clinic or mental health kind of setting, traditional setting. So I did get a job for about a year in a day treatment program. And back in the day, those were very, Medicaid reimbursed services. And I hated it. I hated it because I lost that, that collaborative kind of relationship that I had in the clubhouse. It's separated, and I had to be the therapist. Okay, it wasn't working with people, it was providing therapy or services to people, and it was never a comfortable role for me. So, I was there for about a year, and I thank God to this day, Restoration Society gave me a call and they say, "Hey, we got funding to open up a new clubhouse in the city. Would you be interested in coming back and serving as the program manager of that?" And of course, absolutely no questions asked. I was there. So then I worked there for a number of years. So I moved around a little bit, and you work a while and you move up a grade. Okay. So in that job at the time, our county had acquired some grant funding to begin to train workforce, and they were looking for people to be trained in a new model. Back then, it was called the model of psychiatric rehabilitation. It's a kind of a transformative model that came out of Boston University that was really making an impact on mental health services around the country. So I was very fortunate to be selected to go through the training to become a psychiatric rehabilitation practitioner. After that, I was offered the opportunity to go through a train the trainer. So I was going to they trained me to be a trainer of other people. That's where I kind of caught that bug of teaching. I love that idea of teaching other people. To me, it's not just teaching, it's inspiring others. And I was very excited about this psychiatric rehabilitation model because it really challenged the status quo. And again, my passion around social justice and change, I just liked that. It kind of turned the medical model on its side and kind of shrunk the idea of treatment to being a component of a much larger umbrella of recovery and rehabilitation. So years ago, our whole system was built around a treatment model, treating symptoms, treating diseases, right? Our mental health system. That wasn't working particularly well with people with severe mental illness. Just because we reduce symptoms does not mean that a person with a severe mental illness is able to go out and get a job or live independently in the community. They need to develop skills, right?
Skills.
Sounds perfect for OT, doesn't it? I mean, that defines OT. So
It
I
does.
knew, I saw that right away. So when I learned that model of psychiatric rehabilitation, I knew right away that this is a model that is very congruent with OT. That excited me. Found out about a job opening at where I went to school, Erie Community College. Went for a job interview there, prepared my resume. Turns out that the program director, as I alluded to earlier, just so happened to be the person who was my level two fieldwork supervisor when I was a
Oh,
student.
wow.
And Betsy Jones, tough lady, very tough. She had a reputation among students and graduates as being very tough, but I worked hard when I did my level two. She was impressed. I got the job,
And
and
remembered you,
she remembered me. And at the time, I had only had a bachelor's degree at that point. I got a bachelor's degree in community mental health. And why she hired me, you'd have to ask her. I would tell people to this day, I would not have hired me. But I took the job. It was, my gosh, I had no idea what I had gotten myself into. Didn't know, really know how to organize around teaching and developing my own kind of pedagogy around, teaching. But I struggled and I guess I got better and better at it. So I was at Erie Community College for 18 and a half years, and then I was sought out by another college to start a new OTA program in Rochester. And I had gone through some life changes at the time, and I thought I need to do something different. So I took on that challenge, and I worked for 8 years at Bryant and Stratton College. I started that program and left it in really good hands. If anybody is a leader, the best thing you can do as a leader is to bring on people and empower the people who you bring on, and anything that you can do to enable them to even be greater than you, go for it. Just go for it. And because I'm so glad. The person I left behind is just phenomenal. So it was a great time for me to leave that job and transition back to working at Restoration Society. So that's my nutshell version.
Well, I love the 360 loop of everything. I mean, it couldn't be any neater than that. And you spoke a lot about passion, and I have no doubt in my mind that Betsy Jones saw that sparkle of passion, right, from you when you as a student, and then later on too, once you interviewed for the position, and how that speaks volumes. And obviously, it's such a great motivator as a professional, right? As a
I
healthcare
think,
professional. This is not easy work, what we do, and particularly working in mental health, I think can really be depleting sometimes, right? So
Absolutely,
you
yeah.
need to have that passion, you need to have that drive, and you need to really have that vision, right? And kind of
I
have
think
that
so.
focus.
And your listeners, I guess they're looking, what can they take away from interviewing these interviews? And I really believe passion sells. And if you can, and I don't know if it's about finding your passion, but building whatever passion is within you. I suppose there's a certain element where you got to find something that you're interested enough in, but being passionate is something that it's an attitude, and it's an outlook, I guess. It was easy for me to become passionate around OT and mental health, but it's that passion that I think draws other people to you.
Yes.
And it's that that passion that kind of gets other people excited, I think. And maybe it's that passion that people are attracted to, that kind of that when they see other people who are passionate, maybe it gives them hope and it gives them excitement.
Yes.
So I've always, went with the things that I'm most passionate about, and it's worked well for me.
I'm so happy that you stuck with it because you've done so much. And I want to talk more about, I guess, your current role and, what a typical day. What's a typical day like for you? What kinds of, I know that you're not necessarily there in an occupational therapy capacity, right? But you are an occupational therapy practitioner inside and out. You live it, you breathe it. You can't take your goggles off ever anymore.
So my background in OT has very well prepared me for the job that I'm in, because the job that I'm in is overseeing services and supports that are built around occupations, whether it be living occupations, working with people with housing, whether it be employment, helping people to get jobs, whether it be just general psychiatric rehabilitation, supporting people in pursuing community engagement or volunteering and things like that. And this is a question that I think our profession has to answer eventually. Is it OT or is it not? That's the question. And I would draw everybody's attention to take a look at, and I'm going to look this up right now, but our Vision 2025, AOTA's Vision 2025, I ask people to read that oftentimes because it does not describe what you would normally think of as a health profession. I'm just going to read it. As an inclusive profession, occupational therapy maximizes health, well-being, and quality of life for all people, populations, and communities through effective solutions that facilitate participation in everyday living. That describes my job,
Me too.
right?
It
And
doesn't say anything about hospital,
nope, says nothing
SNF.
about sickness or disease.
Yes.
And I always point that out when I share this with students. It says nothing about disease. The vision for our profession is moving beyond that medical model, right? That I talked about earlier, that we've kind of flipped on its side. And that model is being flipped everywhere. I was just at a meeting last week of C-level, corporate level people from community health agencies and mental health agencies. The entire meeting was about social determinants of health and how agencies and services need to be focusing on addressing those barriers that contribute to health outcomes. And one doctor spoke, she said 10% of my job is focusing on a disease itself, but you look at the outcomes, 90% of those outcomes are impacted by those social determinants of health. So if you look at that, healthcare and services should follow the lead on that and recognize that if we can address those social barriers, those inequities because of marginalization, because of racism, because of
Lack of
poverty,
access, yeah.
that's where we're moving as a profession. And
Yes.
that vision statement talks to me about that. Our new ACOT standards speak very clearly about addressing social determinants of health. So to go
Yes.
back to your comment earlier about, well, you're not doing OT, or are you doing OT? It's the future that's really going to define what OT is. And it may not be so clearly defined as working with somebody doing grading and adapting tasks in a clinical setting. It's doing exactly what I'm doing.
Yes.
So I Can I say, well, I'm doing OT? I don't know. How does an attorney who's no longer practicing in a courtroom but works as a CEO of a company, he or she is practicing law in a sense by utilizing that knowledge base, that skill set to run a company, right? Or how does a doctor, a physician who then takes on the job as a CEO of a health network, are they going to say, I'm now no longer practicing medicine? I think they would define themselves just as much as being a doctor. That attorney would define his or herself just as much as being an attorney in those particular roles. And I think as a profession, we need to kind of challenge ourselves to get outside of those clinical boxes that we've kept for so many years. Again, that vision statement says nothing about diseases.
It
Okay.
doesn't. It
It's about
doesn't. And
maximizing your life experiences, participating in everyday life. That's what I do. I
yes.
support programs that do that. I employ people that are going to fill jobs that are going to do that service. I work on developing new programs that are going to do those things that are defined in AOTA's 2025 vision.
Yeah, in
So.
fact, to me, it speaks the idea of having to be elsewhere that we're not currently at, right? To be in environments where where we have not yet introduced our service, because that's where our clients are.
I don't think you get any more occupation-based than the services that we provide in the community, in a person's home, on the job, right? And we're enabling people to be successful at performing the essential occupations that make up their roles within those environments. I don't think you get more occupation-based than that, in
No.
my opinion.
Can you give us an example?
Of well, I'm in an administrative role, but the examples I could give are the housing services that we provide people. So we practice, we utilize a housing first model. So what that means is a person who has a severe mental illness, despite the fact that whether or not they are compliant in taking their medication, whether or not they are using alcohol or drugs or not, we don't let that be a barrier to us working with that individual to helping them to find a place to live. So we work with that individual in choosing, getting, and keeping housing in the community. So we will work with them to look at their funding, what they're able to get in terms of supporting them to afford an apartment. We will look at other sources and grant funds out there. We will work with them to identify where in the community that they want to live, and we will do our very best to work with them to identify specific apartments, and we will help them by viewing those apartments and going through the application process to eventually find them a place to live in the community. Once they got that apartment, we have employees who are their job is to work with that individual to establish that apartment. We have access to furniture and things like that, some of which sometimes we have the funding to purchase new furniture with them there because of their eligibility. Other times we collect donations of furniture. Either way, we'll try to help set them up with an apartment. Then ongoing, they will have a person who will work with them to help them to adjust to living in that apartment, whether it be, going food shopping, acquainting them with the local laundromat or the bodega down the street, helping them to figure out public transportation to and from where they live, working with them to maybe we'll actually escort them to their appointment to their clinic, their counselor or whatever. So that's the kind of stuff that we do. Now, the challenge that I have and the vision I have is that we don't necessarily employ OT practitioners in those roles, but those roles sound like the jobs of OT practitioners.
Took the question right out of my mind. I was going to ask if you have students. Do you have an internship
We do.
program?
We do. So And I'm working on, I've been in my, this is a pretty new job for me. In fact, just prior to our meeting tonight, I was sitting with four OT students who I'm working with from University at Buffalo and orienting them. And they have a project where they have to do a needs assessment with some of our customers and kind of formalize some kind of strategy to work with them to address the needs. And it's probably going to be more of a group kind of thing. I have not yet introduced OT students to our housing services. I would love to be able to do that. The challenge that we have is around supervision, right? And this is where I have a challenge as an occupational therapy assistant. So I can certainly bring in OT, level one OT students, and I'm going to be placing them in those non-traditional kinds of settings. So that we can do. I cannot yet bring in level two students, which is my goal. Although we do have a board member who's an occupational therapist, and he is working with some OT students here. But I want to kind of expand that program. My vision someday is, my desire is to someday be able to actually employ an occupational therapist. One of the thoughts that I have is could we, you know, what can we afford with our funding? And then could we partner with a university or two? Or maybe, you know, hey, AOTA, if you're listening, maybe you would want to, partner and help fund some kind of centers of excellence, and we'll be one of them, and around the country, where we combine funding from different sources so that we could afford to employ a full-time occupational therapist in our agency, whose job will then be, among other things, to be a level two supervisor of
Supervisor.
students, perhaps students from around the country, because we're a center of excellence, and we're able to kind of create this revolving process of bringing in OT students. Now, I have heard of other agencies that have done that have gone beyond that, and they've been successful in getting grant funding to actually employ more OTs. So that's my long-term retirement vision
Oh, I think that's just
here.
coming down the pike just because these models are out there. I want to connect you with some people after our
Great.
call. These are, so many great things that you're
I know
doing.
Columbia University has a program like that, and they just recently published an article in OT Practice, the September issue. Really compelling article. And in fact, I printed that article off, and actually I sent it to several schools around here and say just, and I said, read this article and see if this kind of gets you thinking, because I would love to talk. So
I
I'm very
actually
hopeful.
I'm proud to have been one of Robin's OTs. I worked at Project Renewal when I was in New York.
That's yep.
Yes, and I also ran my own student internship program. I was the OT manager at Barrier Free Living.
Nice.
It's a domestic violence program, and they also have shelters, but that's the model that you described, where they hired me as a consultant to provide supervision to OT students. That's how it worked for 15 years. And now we have another amazing OT who's taken over my role. Her name is Simone Allen, and she's still there now, doing a fantastic job. So it's a wonderful model. I really think, definitely connect with Robin. She's the
Yeah,
mastermind
I've
when it
Robin
comes
actually
to this.
presented to our state association, and we've had some conversations. And then the Mental Health Task Force out of New York is another group of very passionate people that are kind of keeping this conversation going. But yeah, that's my hope in my new job, is to eventually bring in something like that. I'm slowly building. Yeah, I'm building. I just go
I want to be involved. I want to
ahead.
be
Okay, yeah,
involved. I want
sure.
to assist. I know I'm way over here, but I'm sure that there are ways to figure things out. But
I'm
so
building our board of directors, and I'm bringing in OTs to serve on our board of directors at this point. So that's my backdoor way of kind of getting this going. So I have one OT who's already on our board, and I just brought in another OT, and I hope to do more. And then that's going to start planting the seeds here.
Yes. Oh, that's excellent. All right. So we talked a little bit about the setting that you're currently working in. We talked about a typical day and what it might be like, really working on very occupation-based types of things, and having sort of like a peer-run program that's sort of fueling all of that. I love everything. Are there any recent successes or recent lows that you want to share with us in terms of this role?
In terms of what? I'm sorry,
In terms of your role?
my role. Every day I have successes and failures. So, well, I something I was really excited about was, last week attending this conference and being able to have a conversation with an official from our state who had familiarity with OT and has now reached back out to me and has invited me, and I'm also pulling in a colleague from our state OT association in to have some conversations because the state is going to be opening up our state mental health system, so to speak, for redesign, and they're looking to stakeholders to provide some input. So she actually responded, from my conversation, reached out to me and invited me to participate in that. So I'm really, really, really excited about that.
Congrats. Oh, again, I'm so grateful that you'll be there to speak on our behalf.
Failures happen every day in terms of the lows. I'd say a failure is when we have a customer. And again, we refer to the people who we serve as our customers. We really want to, kind of patient doesn't work because we're out in the community. Client kind of got worn out as a term, and it became stigmatizing. So we kind of moved to this idea of customer. Maybe that'll be something else in the future. Yeah, when we have a dissatisfied customer, I feel like we failed. I was in a meeting today with one such customer who was not satisfied with the services that we were providing, didn't feel fully listened to, didn't feel that their needs were being fully addressed. So I felt very bad, but also, I could flip it around and say, well, it's this person's dissatisfaction was important enough that we pulled together our CEO, myself, managing director, as well as the director of our housing services, to meet with this person and her counselor to discuss things. We put together probably we were together for probably almost 2 hours, going over, her services, what she was not satisfied, trying to really pinpoint the areas of dissatisfaction. So I guess, I felt bad, but I guess the good thing is that, we said point blankly, you have choices where you receive services. We want you to be aware that you have those choices, and we will, if you want to have access services elsewhere, we will work with you to do that. But she ultimately decided to continue to work with us. We did kind of articulate, some an agreement in terms about, what's reasonable for her to expect of us, what's reasonable for us to expect of her, and we'll be providing that to her and her counselor. And moving forward, we're going to try again to work with her. What saddens me is that there's so much need out there, agencies like ours are understaffed. There's a significant workforce shortage out there. We don't have the people. And part of her dissatisfaction was our inability to provide what she needed, soon enough. And again, some of those are things, it's factors that are out of our control, but we still have to take responsibility for them. So it pains me. It pains me when a customer is not served well. It's got to be, I know that it's very difficult for a person with a severe mental illness. You're already stigmatized. You're already in a system where the people who care about you or for you are in paid roles. That's got to be a hard, circumstance to deal with. Our systems and services oftentimes add trauma
Yes.
to the trauma that a person has already experienced.
Yeah.
So, I feel bad. Did we add to the trauma for her because she felt let down in some of
Yes.
the services that we're able to provide her? So that pains me.
Well, it sounds like you have a really great system in place in terms of, resolving, not resolving, but just paying attention to people's gripes, right? To
I
whatever, to their
guess,
feedback. I think sometimes that's, half of it is really just making sure that there's a platform so folks can speak their mind and feel as if they're being listened to, right? And then, of course, the action
absolutely,
is
yeah.
always important, but I think in my experiences it's yeah, just being a listener and being of support and helping, helping someone feel like, I hear you. I hear you. I hear you. This is what's going on. But also being present with them during that conversation, right?
Definitely. It's I mean, you're taking a glass half full perspective, and that's I need to do that after tonight when I go home to do that. But in the midst of it, her dissatisfaction points out flaws in our system, weaknesses in our system. Generally speaking, community mental health workforce is not always well trained. We don't rely on highly credentialed people in those jobs. Oftentimes, the positions where the workers that spend the most time with people are oftentimes the least credentialed and the least paid people. It's no
Yes.
different than our system of serving elderly people in nursing homes. The people who are least paid and least trained are the people who are spending the most time with people. And that pains me that our system is built around that. And
Yes.
that's why I'm attracted to models that kind of reverse that. There's models in nursing homes. Eden Alternative, for example, is a very intriguing model that kind of elevates the boots on the ground employee and makes them a part of the team, and brings the resident in as part of the team. There's a lot more collaboration, teamwork, and it begins to raise the morale of employees and things like
Yes,
that.
absolutely. So
It's
maybe we can segue into that sort of that question, I guess, in terms of, money matters. Is there anything that you can share with us with regards to money matters? It can go anywhere from, salary to however ways you might be getting compensated in this role. I know your role is again like you have sort of like a managing director role there, so I'm not sure how that looks.
So typically, with a lot of the grants that we are working off, serving, you submit. There's it's kind of set what your workforce will be paid, those salary rates, and then to operate those grants, there's always that administrative piece where part of that grant funding goes to support that administration. This is stuff that I'm just learning now. So any of your listeners will probably be able to say you're wrong, Dave. But my understanding is that we don't have that much flexibility just to enhance people's salaries. You have to spend that money in certain ways because your state funding sources require
You're
it.
gonna lose it next year.
And again, I'm pretty sure that that's the case because our state governor has recently, made some statements about we're going to do this. We're going to build in incentives to attract people to the workforce. We're going to build in some means of enabling you to fund training for employees. We're going to create incentives for employees to pursue certain credentials. It's the state, again, because we're so dependent upon that. If we were not so dependent upon the state, and as an agency, we worked on more other foundations, you know, grants and things like that, which we're trying to do that. We are working with a company that works with us to help us to apply for such grants. Okay. You know, maybe down the road we're going to be able to enhance salaries of employees. We're still waiting. The state's going to be coming through with some stuff, and we're going to be able to enhance mm-hmm. people's salaries. I feel terrible for our current employees because we've been telling them that for a while, and they're waiting, and you know, it gets frustrating for them.
Yes. And again, it's not easy work, right? But it's yep. great that you're there advocating. Are there any OT skills that really sort of stick out for you that you think have really come into play in your role as managing director?
Well, gee, OT skills that really come into play. Well, absolutely therapeutic use of self. Hugely. Any relationship is built around, is this going to be a trusting relationship or mm-hmm. is this not going to be a trusting relationship? If it's not a relationship where trust is involved, you're going to assume roles of authority. You're going to be dictatorial.
Yes.
I don't operate that way. Most people don't like to be operated on in that mm-hmm. way. It involves building relationships with people. So I'm fairly new in my role, and I intentionally did not want to come in as I'm the director and I'm going to come in and take over. I have done a lot of listening,
mm-hmm.
okay, a lot of reflective listening. So, you know, I think of models like intentional relationship model, mm-hmm. Renee Taylor's model, and how, you know, you got to kind of scope out what kind of mode does the recipient need and
yeah.
want. And so I look at that, and you know, I don't know that our employees want a problem-solving mode for me quite yet. They're mm-hmm. looking for problems to be solved. I know that, but I want them to feel comfortable and trust. I want them to have some trust. And
yeah.
So I'm doing a lot of empathy mode.
Yes.
And encouraging mode where it's needed, because I'm seeing workers feeling very depleted. So I guess in terms of skill set, kind of scoping out and looking, you know, and that intentional relationship model is kind of gives me a little lens to look through.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of scoping out what are the modes that people are needing and wanting.
Yeah.
And I'm doing that because I want to build trust. I want to know that I respect the workers.
Yeah.
I appreciate what they're doing because they are doing a lot. I know they're very frustrated at times. So I'm trying to do a lot of empathizing. But I'm seeing a shift now. If I could apply, I don't know if there's any literature out there about applying intentional relationship mode to scoping out groups of people. Maybe there is. I understand it on an individual basis,
mm-hmm.
but I'm seeing a shift now where employees are now wanting more problem-solving mode. You know, so they're kind of saying, "Okay, we understand. You understand us. We appreciate that, but we still got issues here. What are you going to do?"
Yes. So they're done with the kind of complaining. Talking about the problem. They're talking about the problem, but now there's more of a sort
yeah.
of proactivity
yeah.
or focus.
I mean, to me, complaining
resolve.
is, people are asking for something. When people
mm-hmm.
complain, they're asking to be heard and to be and recognized for what they're experiencing.
Yes.
And they want to be validated.
Mm-hmm.
That's my take
yeah.
on that. So there's a point at which I can, you know, do that validation. But eventually people have this readiness to move on to the next step, maybe, in a relationship. And ultimately, and I'm not an expert on intentional relationship model, but I've, you know, read about it and kind of shared it with, you know, I've included in talking to my OTA students in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I have to come to a place where we need to be ready to collaborate,
mm-hmm.
and that collaboration mode, which requires that both parties or all parties are committed to working together. It's not me solving their problem, but it's us being at a place where we're going to work together to solve our problem. I want to be able to get there with our teams so that we could look at some of the issues that we have.
Yes. Well, thanks for bringing up some of those very key sort of OT skills. I heard you say, you're kind of looking at your using your systems perspective, right? And being able to identify needs that, each of these subgroups need from you as the
Absolutely.
person who's managing the whole thing, right? You're building rapport, you're building relationships, you're listening, you're observing, right? These are all sort of core OT skills that we have, and I'm glad that you highlighted them. What are some, or are there any, common myths or misconceptions in your current role that you'd like to demystify?
Misconceptions. Well, a very can I talk about misconceptions about mental health and mental
Oh,
illness?
boy.
So we can talk about that. I fundamentally believe that people with severe mental illness can and do recover. I mean, that's paramount. That's the foundation of the model of psychiatric rehabilitation. That's the foundation of our federal government, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, put out some papers on recovery. That's foundational to the President's New Freedom Commission that published reports saying that our systems have to be built around not the assumption that people are going to be sick for the rest of their lives, but the assumption that people can and do recover from severe mental illness. So a common misconception out there is that people who have severe mental illness, they're going to be so severely mentally ill that they're not going to have a life worth living. Ain't true.
Nope.
And I know
That's where we
people.
come in as
Yeah.
OTs, right?
Yep.
That's exactly where we come in.
But even in our own profession and in society, we bring in systemic biases, right? Implicit
Absolutely.
biases, because every day you hear on the news, get those crazies off the street. You hear a president say that when there's a mass killing. But people kind of see that and they think, well, then we need to have laws that when a person is mentally ill, we have to force them to be hospitalized. We have to force them to be on medication. What that does is then create an adversarial system that the people, the very services we want to provide, the people are adverse to those services because of this kind of threat of forced treatment. We don't do that with any other sickness. We don't force treatment on a person who has high blood pressure. We don't force treatment on a person who has diabetes. We have a welcoming system that invites them in and says, what can we do to support you? And therefore, that person wants to utilize those services. Our mental health system isn't always built around that.
No, it's
And then
not.
workers get kind of tired in those systems. And then you see a person who might be in a state of symptoms, maybe active psychosis, and our immediate assumption is this person is no longer competent to make decisions for themselves. And if we approach them as if they can't make decisions for themselves, we're going to create responses built around coercion and mandating. But if we kind of say, even though they are symptomatic, they can still think things through. They can think about what they want to do. They might need more time and support in doing so, we need to do that. So, those misconceptions lead to systems and services and people who reinforce those stereotypes. I believe
And
that a
on
person with severe mental illness, schizophrenia, can get a job, can live on their own. And I know it because I know people that have been in those situations.
Yes, me too.
Yeah.
I think this is a great segue to the next question. And, speaking to future OTAs, future OTs out there, what career advice do you have for them if they're interested in following your path?
My advice would be if you're a student, see if you can do level two in community mental health settings. Really push your school to find that for you. Maintain your identity as an OT practitioner. If I had any regret, when I first began working in mental health, I lost that connection with my profession for a number of years until I returned to academia. Maintain that identity, and I tell everybody, I know it costs money, but be a member of your national association, AOTA. Be a member of your state association. If you want to build your career, not just a job, but build a career, the greatest opportunities to do that are through volunteering within your state and national mm-hmm. association. They will, especially OTAs, they will scoop you up, okay? Because they need to. They know that they need to, because if they don't, they're going to hear from people, okay? They need to, and they want to. I've been on the board of AOTA. We want OTAs. Okay. Take on those opportunities.
We want representation, so for all the OTAs listening.
Absolutely. My growth and my development as a professional, much of that came through my volunteer leadership through AOTA, serving on the Representative Assembly, eventually serving for a 3-year term on AOTA's Board of Directors. Some of the best experience, some of the most fun experiences of my career were doing that. Same thing with my state OT association, New York State Occupational Therapy Association. They will scoop you up. You need to, again, a career is not a job. A job is 40 hours. A career is more than that. Mm-hmm. A career is putting in free time. It just is. And if you want to advance to be a leader, you have to acquire experiences that demonstrate your leadership. Mm-hmm. That's what you need to do.
Thank you so much for that wonderful piece of advice. Yeah. So I couldn't agree more. Listeners connect with you, how do they get in touch?
The
is
easiest
that okay
way
if they do?
I have a website only because I use that website. And I take a look at the website and do the same thing if you're an OTA trying to build your reputation and get jobs. I created a website to kind of house my resume, my portfolio, my CV. So easiest way to reach me, davidmerlo.com, M-E-R-L-O. So davidmerlo.com. There's a contact me page at the end. Reach out to me. I would love to talk to anybody out there to encourage them to share more. And I do that. People reach out to me, and it's thrilling for me, and I'm nearing actual retirement. You look at Eric Erickson's, the stages of psychosocial development. Mm-hmm. I'm nearing that final stage where you want to think about legacy, and I'm all about that. I want to leave something. That's my occupation now, is building something to leave behind. Reach out to me. I'd love to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. I have no doubt in my mind that you're already leaving a legacy, and that what you're trying to create is just down the pike. That's coming to us all very, very soon, and I'm so excited to hear more about it. Thank you so much for all the work that you do, your advocacy, your teachings, right? For sharing your journey with us and for sharing your passion. I think, that's the part that's going to be the most contagious. Thank you for spending the time.
Thank you very, very much.
And that wraps up another inspiring episode of the Uncommon OT series. Connect with me at www.transitionsot.com. And don't forget to sign up to be part of the Transitions OT community. By doing so, you'll receive my latest compiled list of Uncommon OT practice settings, the latest news on mentoring offerings, Uncommon OT live events, non-traditional OT resources, and more. You may also follow me on my social media pages on Instagram and LinkedIn. And if you love this episode, head on over to Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, and Google Podcasts to follow, rate, and leave a review. I also ask you to consider pledging your support to my passion podcast project by being a patron on Patreon. It is very much appreciated. Sending big OT love. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.